first panelist speaker to share on the second tradition is Sophie.
Hi, Sophie Alcoholic.
Hi, Sophie.
So thank you, Rich, for asking me to speak about 1 hour on the second tradition. So first of all, tradition two, for a group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are requested servants, they do not govern. And I'm going to read you the long form, which, fun fact, is shorter than the short form. So the long form of tradition two. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. So I qualify to be here. I'm an alcoholic. I have qualified years. And over my time in AA, I definitely have seen tradition two and how it comes to play in our group. So especially I can use it related to group because that is my own group and that's where I've really seen tradition two at play. And the biggest thing is we have one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself through our group conscience. So God is really what is leading the group. God is what's leading AA, and God is kind of directing us through the group. And our leaders are requested servants, they do not govern. So we have servants to God, not actual servants, so let's not take it super literally. But we have elected people. So our group conscience is how God is speaking to everybody, and we elect someone to lead the group and lead kind of what God would have us do. So, for example, Rich was elected by the group, and God was speaking to the group to have Rich lead us this year. Next year, we will rotate. We'll have someone new because Rich is not the government of the group. We don't have a government of the group. We're not a country. And with countries, we have, you know, laws and rules and regulations, and that's not what AA has. We have a group conscience, so at any point, we can change things if it would be best for the group. Different groups have different group consciences, which is what leads us to having different group formats, different meetings. So if you don't like this format, you can go find a different group with a different format and a different trusted leader for the semester, for the year, however they do it. And that's how God is speaking to their group. That's how they're being led. So I know there's always, you know, as with a group of alcoholics, we always have people that will say, well, I don't like these rules, and I don't like this, and I don't like that. You know, I think we've all been there, myself included. And what it really comes down to is, well, if you don't like something, you can have God kind of speak through you, and you can attend a business meeting where things can change, and you can elect someone new to lead the group in maybe a slightly different direction. And there's a great example in the 12 to 12 reading about tradition two. So basically, this guy moves to Middletown, USA. And there's no AA there. And he decides, well, I'm going to start AA. And goes and collects his alcoholics and gets them sober. And they start this meeting. And his first thought is like, well, you know, we're doing a pretty good job. We have this meeting going. We got people sober. They're in the group. It's growing. It's great. We probably should just stay and do what we're doing and leave the meeting and not have any changes. And the group conscience spoke, and there was an uprising, and they were like, thanks, but no thanks. We want some changes in the meeting. We want some changes in the group. And as a result, they held elections. And these older timers, these founders of the meeting, some were re-elected, some were not. And that's the group speaking. That's God speaking through the group. And change happened, and they talk about in the group, you know, some of these people, they stayed angry, they stayed in their resentment, and they went out and got drunk because, you know, they lost their position of authority. And other people came to see see that this is the process. This is how it's supposed to go. There's this rotating movement. You know, AA is different every single time you come in. There's new faces. There's new amounts of sobriety. Thank you. And it's never going to look the same. Tonight will look this way, and next week it's going to look totally different. There's going to be a whole group of new faces, and there's going to be a whole group of faces that aren't here anymore. So it really is this kind of beautiful, evolving thing. And if we were to have these set leaders, well, then it doesn't give room to grow and to be this living, evolving thing, which is really what our sobriety is. And as we go through the work, we grow, we change, and isn't that kind of what we want our programs and our groups to be? This not stagnant kind of idea, because certainly life is not like that. Every day it's going to be something new. We have a new 24 hours tomorrow to do something new, try something out again. So that's kind of just an initial, basic, my reading into this. And then if we read a little bit further into Tradition 2, then we talk about Bill and how he was offered by Charlie at the church, excuse me, at the hospital, to basically, he was like, you're doing great work here. We love what you're doing. And this is 3 years into AA being started. He's like, you're doing great stuff. Come work for me. We're going to have an office. You're going to get a ton of money. You're totally broke. Like, come make money off of this thing. And he gets on the subway, goes to Brooklyn. He's like, Lois is exhausted. She's working in the department store. She's working for all the drunk guys. Making money. I'm going to do it. That's it. And then he brings it to the meeting. And they say, well, Bill, if you're making money off of it, how is it just given away? All of a sudden, this is now an organization. This is not the point of the group. And Bill realized that his initial thought on the subway of, ha, this is it. Like, now I'm going to finally get, like, my dues from being sober and helping all these people. I'm going to make money. That wasn't God speaking to him. It was just him speaking to himself and, you know, what we often do. And really God was in the voices of his fellows, of telling him, Bill, you can't do this. You got to just kind of keep doing what you're doing. And eventually things are all going to work out. And things sort of didn't work out. I mean, look at us, we're all here. We're sober, we're getting sober. And so that's kind of the beauty of having this kind of idea of rotation and God being in charge. I can only talk for myself, but I definitely had issues with authority. So, like, coming in and being like, well, that person's in charge, thanks, but no thanks. I mean, definitely when I came in, my first meeting was Thursday, and I had total resentments against the chairs of the meeting because I was like, well, they're the bosses of AA. But then all of a sudden, you know, 11 months later, we had new people. And then new people are leaving. And you have a totally new experience. So, to take anything away from this, is that let's embrace the beauty of rotation. Let's embrace the change. Embrace God seeing through other people. Because that's really how we keep evolving. And if we're going to be kind of in a role of leadership, to not be open to embracing the ideas and knowledge of new people, it doesn't allow the group to grow, and it doesn't allow the group to evolve in a way that really matches where people are today, which is really a beautiful thing, because where we were 5 years ago is not where we are today. And what a lucky thing that we have to change each year, every 6 months, and have a new experience. So I'm just about out of time, but thank you again, Rich, and thank you all of you for listening to me, and thank you.
So, Grew up in Brooklyn, New York, a little town in Brooklyn. And loving parents. For normal parents, my dad was workaholic and very strict. My mom was just like awesome and peaceful and just one of my idols in life. And so then I was my older brother, who another idol in my life, always gets what he wants and work in school and that, and I was envious of him a lot of times, and it was just crazy. And there's this kid, dyslexic kid, who struggled in school, struggled with everything, went to high school somehow, went to college, that was a big mistake. Majored in alcoholism in college, and parties, and thrown out, and it was terrible. And I don't know why you sent me so far, but but a lot of it is this craziness. I came back here, I tried work, did this, had a car, had this, lost a lot of I lost relationships. I was all over the place, and it was just disgraceful, and I couldn't put two sentences together. It was a nightmare to be with. Like, I hang out with bad people. I was attention getter, and that was just not fun to be around. I couldn't even, like, my father, like, lost his trust. Lost his, like, almost love. He was, like, didn't know what to do with me and all that. And then I was lying to everybody around me, and then it was after my train, she was catching on. And then we had an intervention, and my dad's like a big time lawyer in New York. He's scary. He's still scary. He's calmed down a lot. And it was me and my brother and a couple other stuff, and mom and dad, and they were all talking about me. My mom said, Tom, why not you, like, make some new positive friends and positive people in your life? I said, I was so scared. I didn't know what to do. I was in tears half of the time. And my dad, who always jokes up, he started crying. He didn't know what to do. And to see him cry like that, it was like, so something in my heart says, Tom, behave. Do what the man says, do what my father says, and do what everybody around you who loves you care about. And so I went back to his house. It was like a sober house. He said, do what he says. Everything was going good. And went to meetings, went to outpatient, went to work, went to his house, went to meetings, outpatient. I did that my first year, and then I got, he's like, okay, enough with you. So I got my own house, he trusted me, it's my own place, and he gave me a sober dog. So it's one of my, like, I loved animals, and later in life, you hear what I do, and I had a job that people went to, they saw me when I was drunk, it was my father's friend's boss, so I could screw up even worse. I did. I thought I was going to get thrown out many times. You know, I was scared. I came like all messy, all terrible, and all that. And they still was like, okay, go, or hang over, or do this and that. And I was like, okay. But now I was there, my first year clean, I was like showing up. I was doing a job. I was a part of something. I went to, they had, like, parties and everything there. Holiday parties. I was, like, I talked to people to see what I did, and I stayed in the now, and I was scared to call or leave. And my, guy I worked with, he was, like, cool. He was, like, okay, we'll let you, I'll watch you like a hawk, so you're not drinking. Stick with me, everybody stick with me. And then 3 years down the road, everybody got, like, outsourced and let go, and they did me a favor. I was first scared when they left that company. I was there for 15 years, the longest time I ever had anything in my life. And they did me a favor by letting me go. And I was like, now what? I'm scared. I got a new sponsor. And he's like, all right, what's your passion? What's your love? So I was like, animals, I think. And I was like, yeah, I love animals. And so I wanted that. I worked with somebody here. They watched me under the wings. And then I grew even in blizzards and stuff. I still walk out. So I was like, damn, this is what I love. And suddenly, boom, I worked at shelters, daycares, and that and that. And now I own my own business. It's a miracle. And 5 years later, the business is strong. People trust me. My dad trusts me. And our relationship is so sweet. Like my mom, years ago, wanted to find a sober certification for me and meet with people and get out of the city. And I go on every year. Last year was Jamaica. All that was pretty cool. And I meet new people, new friends. I got friends here. People trust me. I got keys to people's houses. I tell my parents I got some sober tattoos. Strong prayer and everything. But the number one for me is service. I love to show up for service. I don't care if I'm feeling sick, nothing. I can get a drink easy. So services should be five meetings I go to, I have five commitments, I have my own business, if I get sick, I'm in trouble because I'm my own boss, so I do another job, I dress up and I do a part-time doorman because somebody trusts me, and it's awesome stuff, it's amazing, and I had 6 months, and they gave me the keys for the monster state to do with meditation. I was like, how long was this for? It was for 6 months or so, 3.5 years later. I was doing the meditation there, and it was phenomenal. And, there's stuff I have to work on, calling people, events, stuff I'm working on. But that's the little stuff in life. The big stuff is what I'm doing is doing a lot of service. I'm growing every day. People trust me. I'm making friends. Who's in friends? I'm not drinking over my teams. I can go to sporting events. I'm like, yes. it's a blessing in disguise. I know every minute is scary. Every time I go out there and do service, even smile at somebody, help somebody who has a stroller up the stairs, just be out of yourself. It's better. Every time I walk a dog, I'm not thinking about me, I'm talking about the dog and thinking about doing that's kind of service, that's kind of meditation. You're not thinking about yourself, you're being a part of. And so I'm running out of time, so look at it. Thanks.
The speaker tonight is Peter.
Hi, I'm Peter. I'm
Hi, Peter.
Really good to be here. Speaking to Mike at the time. All right. Thank you, Rich, for asking me, and thank you, Sophie and Tom, for a great job. Welcome to all the people that are in the first 90 days, because it's not easy getting sober. And I think we'll start with a little speak into the mic. Hey, little joke. There's a guy who walks into a bar, right? And he's down, he looks a little down on his luck. So he says, he sits down at the bar, and the bartender says, what do you need? He says, I need 3 shots of whiskey. He says, all right, he sets them up. Guy drinks them down, 1, 2, 3. bartender goes, "Wow." And he goes, "In quite a hurry, is everything all right?" The guy goes, "Well, if you had what I have, you would drink the same way." He says, "Well, if you don't mind my asking, what do you have?" He said, $1. He reminds me of my drinking. I grew up briefly in Larchmont, nine kids, which was a normal-sized family, probably. Eight boys, one girl. Father was an alcoholic, ex-Marine. And six of us, the boys, ended up getting sober. So we had a lot of alcoholics running around the house. We had boxing gloves. We had all kinds of weapons. We had to defend yourself. So it was kind of fun. It was a lot of fun. I was one of those kids that didn't want to get in trouble because my mother had a canoe paddle to straighten you out. And if that didn't work, she'd say, "Wait for Dad to come home." Dad would pick that little skinny black belt and work it. Worked out pretty good. So I stayed out of trouble. I had to keep my head down, be sneaky Pete. And we were in parochial school, and I saw what happened in those days to kids in parochial school that stepped out of line. And I didn't want that. I really didn't want that. So I kept a low profile. My mother encouraged, there was a quick, I don't know how I thought about this, but most of my older brothers before me went to this one parochial high school, and this guy, the head guy, I don't want to use his name, but my mother loved him, and she told him, "You can meet any of the kids anytime. You got the green light." And she had him over for dinner a couple of times, and my brothers were like, but I went to a different school. When it was my turn. So, I don't know about, I was in the Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, all that, love that stuff, I wasn't really getting in trouble as a kid, but I'll tell you, something happened when I was about 14. I was in a play, and then there was a, the cast party, I guess. And I was a big kid. I was probably 4'11 when I was 14. And I was 5'2 when I got my license when I was 16, so I was kind of a midget. But after this play, there was the party, and before the party, there was somebody got us each a bottle of wine, and the normal thing is to go in behind the bushes and drink your wine. I was a big park drinker, bushes drinker. It was amazing. It was great. It was really great. Something happened to me that night, which I still remember to this day, and I just felt like this. I didn't know I was broken, let's put it that way. I just thought I was shy, but what I realized I had a lot of fear. But wow, the fear was gone. The fear was gone right away. I actually didn't know it, but I was, I could do John Wayne imitations. I found my voice, I could dance, everything. I could talk to the girls. I blacked out that night. Got sick, got in trouble. Story of my drinking. We could just go right to recovery at this point. Give a little more. I was so in my family, you had to work if you wanted money. There wasn't an allowance going around. I remember, like when we were really little, we got like a quarter for allowance, but like. A nickel had to go to the church. I'm like, what a ripoff. Luckily, candy bars were a nickel. So, I was 14. I found drinking. Loved it. Built a house in my backyard. And moved in. I moved into the backyard. Built an A-frame and had like a little porch, and a little back room for the bed. I ran an extension cord out from the house by here, and it was party time. Right in the backyard, like 20 feet from the house, but it was my house. And I had older brothers that realize the advantage of this house in the backyard, and so I would be asked to leave sometimes when the plants come over. I lived out there for over a year, maybe more. There's a bathroom in the house. But I asked my mother if I could get a mailbox. She said, why? You never get mail. I just wanted my own address. I wanted my own house. So that was kind of fun. And then, like I said, we had to work in my house if you wanted money for drinking, and that was important to me. So I worked, you know, all the supermarket, this and that, jobs. I got hired from every single one of them. Because I had a very bad work ethic, and then usually within about a week, I figured I knew more than the boss, pretty much. And I thought they were really strict with when you have to arrive, how many vacations you get. So that's what I drank. You know, I was my mother preached no drugs, so we're not talking about them, and I didn't do them anyway. So I don't have to really restrain myself. I was pretty much a beer drinker, and if I had a little extra, you'd go for some whiskey or whatever. I didn't have a drink of choice. Was that? It was my drink of choice. I never remember saying, "Hey, hey Pete, would you like a gin?" Like, no, that's not my drink of choice. Let's go for it, you know. So, yeah, I got the typical alcoholic car, which is a Volkswagen Bug in those days with no brakes. And it cost $150, and I wrecked it. You know, like, it wasn't on wreck, it was just like hitting a lot of different things. Like, the fenders were falling, everything was falling off. And you drag your foot to stop. The back area was always filled with empty beer cans. And I go, you know, I don't know where I went. I went a lot of days. So I went off to college because my mother had a rule. She said, when you graduate from high school, you can stay here for the summer. And in the September, you have to leave, and I don't care where you go. So we all left. We have to leave. So I went off to college. And I joined a fraternity. Very quickly, one day, two state troopers showed up at my dorm room. Like, I didn't even know they were allowed on campus. Right? They're like, "You're under arrest." Like, okay. So I went down there. It was like, you know, meet the flockers. You know, I put the thing on your finger, like the lie detector thing. And I had no idea why I was there. And they go, "Where were you last night?" I have no idea. They're like, "What do you mean you don't know?" I said, "I had this thing, you know, I don't remember anything when I drank." And then I was called a blackout. I just thought, "I don't remember." I said, "Why? What happened?" They said, "Well, someone stole the stereo out of the campus bar. And, you know, you work there, and your tire tracks were all around." "So did you steal it?" I go, "Maybe." I said, "But I don't think it would fit in my car. It was huge." In those days, in the 70s, stereos were bigger than what was showing up. Anyway, that was just a little example of my drinking. And I had a girlfriend in high school. And just to backtrack a little, I hated dating. I hated that whole thing. I'd rather take a hostage, get one, and just try to treat her well enough to keep her, because when I was going out drinking, there was no, I'm not going out to clean up and go pick up anybody. I'm going out to drink, and I put on, like, jeans, like, you know, dirty club. I'm like, we're drinking, right? I mean, we're not out here, like, dancing. This is a job here. And I had a girlfriend in college, you know, another hostage. I was good at starting out dating, but I was horrible after a very short period of time. You know, first day I was opening the door, doing the whole thing, let's go to dinner at a restaurant. But the third time I wasn't even showing up. You know? Another funny story. I asked this girl on a date one time, and I just bought this Cadillac, which got about 2 miles to a gallon. And I ran out of gas. gas. It's our first date. I ran out of gas like a block from our house. So I walked up to the door. I meet her father and everybody. You know, like, we're going to the movies. And he's like, where's your car? I'm like a block over. Can we borrow your car? That didn't work out well. So, anyway, so the drinking was like that. The hangovers were terrible for me. They were really, I don't miss hangovers. I guess I drank such crappy alcohol or just so much of it. I don't know what happened, but the next day I was worthless. In college, just to kind of speed this up, I'm going to talk about college. I think I spent 6.5 years to try to get my undergraduate degree, which seemed like a long time, but not if you're not a fool like this. I didn't have a plan. I would just like go. There was a big room like this with tables, like this is history, this is whatever. And all I wanted to do was go drinking. So I'd go to the table and had nobody at it, you know, and I'd sign up for all political science, whatever. So every semester was something different. They called me in the office finally. They go, do you have a plan? This isn't my fifth year. I go, no, not yet. And they made a plan for me. But I went to work in Wyoming one time. I tell them it was work study. I was working at the oil field. Nobody was there. It was in the middle of nowhere in Wyoming, right? All you had to do was show up. And I got fired from that. So I was packing my cooler for the ride home. And then the bartender lady goes, her name was Grandma. She carried a soda behind the bar. I said, Grandma goes, where are you going? I go, I'm going back to college. She goes, you will never make it. She knew me so well. So I was back in college, and I had a dog, and I had a dog also, but I had a dog as an alcoholic, which is maybe not the best home for a dog, but I had this dog, his name is Flipper, and Flipper and I were living in a $90 a month luxury off-campus apartment. And I was eating literally rice-a-roni and potatoes, and so was Flipper. And, so Flipper was like the dog in the Grinch. That dog. Get out of there, right? So I'm walking around campus. It was a Monday. It's about a year before I stopped drinking, and I was looking for $10 to get beer. I remember I was joined, I had to have, it was like the middle of the day, it was a Monday, I remember this, and I couldn't find my high school ring. I wanted to hawk that, and I couldn't find it, and I was walking around with Flipper, and this guy I met on campus, he goes, oh, I really like your dog, my dog just passed away, and he goes, don't get ahead of me here. he goes, I'm going to buy a new dog, and I go, oh, really? I said, I'll sell you Flipper. He goes, you will. I go, yes, $10. And they come over to my apartment, I'll give you the leash, or the bowl, whatever. There wasn't much. So we made the sale. And it sounds sad, but Flipper probably ran to the other guy. I case of beer. I'm sitting on the. This was in 1979. Sitting on my stoop, drinking my beer. It was so bad. It's the kind of beer where you get a hangover before you're finished. This is something backwards here. And I started crying. I had like a kind of a moment, like there's really something wrong with me. Really, you know, I knew there was plenty wrong with me, but that was wrong. And that was about 6 months before I got sober. A year before I got sober, my father had died when I was 16, and he had just gotten into AA, which was good. The only thing I knew about that was the Serenity Prayer. And then my mother had died in 1979. Luckily, when I got fired from the job in Wyoming, I got to come home and see her for a week before she died. So everything kind of happens for a reason. I got to say goodbye. The last time I took her out of the house, though, I was so hungover I couldn't move. I was sleeping on the porch, the front porch, and I just kind of looked over. But she never got to see me sober, which is kind of sad. Oops. Okay. Because she was in Al-Anon, and she was really hoping some of us would get sober. So... okay. Mom, so is Daddy. So I got to a point with my drinking where I hated myself, I hated my life. I was a phony, a really bad phony. I would lie or do anything. I was just full of what's in it for me. I could see from the outside who I was. I hated myself. But yet I couldn't stop drinking. You know, I had no off switch. I had no, like, let's wait till Friday switch. I had no, let's have 3 beers, I gotta go home, I gotta get up and work. I didn't have that switch. I never had it right from the beginning. It was like, I didn't understand when somebody in the bar would say, I'm going home. I'm like, what's going on? Oh, I have to get up tomorrow. I gotta go, what? They're still open. You need a couple dollars. I never understood that. Those are called normal drinkers. So I got to a point where I couldn't do it anymore. I don't want to tell another joke, but it is funny. But but anyway, I didn't know any way out. I was 23 years old, and I didn't know there was a way out. I had a kind of a vision, a thought. I don't know what came to me. I think it's the grace of God. Because nobody was telling me to stop drinking. My parents were gone. I was out in Indiana. Nobody, I didn't have a relationship with any woman. And nobody was telling me, hey, Pete, watch your drinking. And that's the way I had set up my life. You know, I don't want anybody to tell me anything. I don't know if anybody can identify with that. So I called one of my brothers to collect. That was a big thing in the early 80s. Wondering if they would accept her call. But my brother accepted the call. I had to go down to a payphone down the block. I forget where. But I said, you know, Chris, nobody ever said this in our family. I have to stop drinking. My thought was, I might live a long time. That was my thought. I wasn't afraid I was going to die. I literally, in the last year alone, I almost went off 2 cliffs. The car was hanging off one and this one, and I was almost fell off a building one night. I would do like stupid things, like to show that I was fearless, you know. Or maybe just stupid things. But I would not have lived that long, I don't think. But in this moment, I thought, my life's going to be really, really crappy. I see no way out. I didn't know sober people. I knew one thing for sure. I couldn't stop drinking. I wasn't a guy who quit drinking for Lent. I quit drinking until I had money in my pocket. That was it. Or you had money in your pocket. And they could talk you into that. So, my brother Chris, when I told him I had to stop drinking or wanted to stop drinking, this is a coincidence too, because my best friend Billy, Liam's uncle, Liam is here, and second generation sober, like it. Actually, third. Chris, my brother said, you know, it's good that you want to stop drinking. Not at all, like, that's good that you want to stop drinking. Why don't you, Billy just got sober. Billy had, came in September, got sober. So he had, this was maybe November. He talked to me from New York, you know, wrote me a letter, he called me. You know, really, like, this guy I used to hang out and drink with all the time. But he, different guy. He was a different guy this is important for all the people that are new. You don't see the change right away, maybe. And there's a lot of people in their first 90 days. The change is already happening. It's already happening, which is incredible to me. So when someone new comes in, a lot of times the people with 39 years, you don't ring a bell so much with a newcomer. But if you have a couple days more than someone else, you can really, really help these people. Really, the more. They say 39, all you guys are thinking, this guy's old. What do you want? I'm not old. But, so, okay, thank you. This is Liam also. So, I started going to AA. I went to a meeting. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic or not. I knew I had a bad drinking problem. I was in Indiana, like I said, and the next youngest person for me was 10 years older. So there's a lot of old people that are like that were like my age, probably now. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter because for an hour when I was in that meeting, I remember this clear. I wasn't angry. I wasn't thinking about drinking. I really like just sat there and like there was a beat. There's something in the room. There's something in this room tonight. There's something in every AA meeting I go to. There's a power in the meeting. And that's why I love meetings. I've never gone away from AA. I've never had a relapse. It's not required. And a lot of people do it. They come in, they go out, they get it. And it's harder the second time. For me, the first time was a total gift. A total gift. People are like, how did you do it so young? I'm like, I don't know. I think the grace of God was there, and I was ready. I totally ran out of gas, and I was ready to listen to somebody. And I can't take credit for that. How could I take credit for that? You know, so I see people that come in, and they're not quite ready, I guess, or they're constitutionally capable. Okay, that's all right. Come back. You know, and so anyway, I got sober, to make this kind of quick. I went through the steps. I got a sponsor after I got yelled at. Group is a marriage group, sort of like this group. Maybe they're not. They give you suggestions, but they're like a hammer on your head. It was a sponsorship meeting, and I said, "Oh, I'm coming new, and I don't have a sponsor yet." So the guy behind me shared when it was his turn. He goes, "Anyone who's been in AA for 6 weeks and doesn't have a sponsor wants to drink." Whipping through, and I did everything perfectly. Now, and matter of fact, it was so hard to write the floor step. It was paralyzing fear because I was never honest with anybody. I had a wall around me, and sometimes I see people with a wall around them, even sober. And until that wall is taken down, and I open up to you or you, that's where God comes into my life. It could be my sponsor, it could be anybody. But I have to open up and share what defects I'm going through, I'm living in. If I'm living in money, power, and sex, and I'm keeping secrets, no good. Not going to work for me. I have one chance at this sobriety, and I work it. And is it easy for me to tell my sponsor what my lustful thoughts are and all that? No. Embarrassing. But keeps me sober, right? Okay, I'm a guy. So I've been in AA for a long time. Like I said, I never left. I sponsor a lot of guys. They help me more than I help them. They call me. We go to meetings. I do service in the group. We talk about service here tonight. I try to work the program. I try to say yes. And I don't try to run the group, by the way. You know, like you were talking about, like Sophie was talking about. I'm like kind of a trusted old-timer and forces take a half a step back and let the people that are coming up have the jobs. That's what saves my life. And they still do. When somebody says, will you do something? I'm like, yeah, of course. I set up chairs. I make lousy coffee. Really bad. I'm surprised I haven't gotten better at it. But anyway, so I was married the first time to a woman in AA. I had my sponsor's approval. She had her sponsor's approval. It still didn't work out. whispering, my confidants were like, eh. I was like, ah. Anyway, I have two great kids, Ron, we do. I got divorced about 10 years ago. I'm only mentioning this because I felt like such a loser. Like, okay, you guys know the math. I was 52, and my brother's like, you want to come live in my home, sleep on my couch? I'm like, no. But thank you. So people help me out. But anyway, I still, being active in AA, involved, having a sponsor that I use a couple times a week, we talk. I still could have made really poor decisions with a woman. It was like amazing to me. And I ran by my network, which I listen to more now. I was like, what do you think? And they're like, no. Like, okay. So when I let go of trying to catch a woman, she doesn't want to be in a relationship. Right? Divorced, whatever. When I let go, my current wife walks in to my life. Only after I let go, though. And I met her in the Stop & Shop, if that helps anybody. Chili for my kids. They were coming down, and I'm looking at a can of Hormel chili on carne, and I'm thinking, does that mean corn? Do I like corn in my chili? I had a whole inner dialogue on corn and chili, and my current wife walks by and gets one of those eight-eater, and I'm like, hey, but I'm back to my candy. And who was that? And I remember somebody, my ex-girlfriend, had introduced me to her, and she was a chef. So I was like, hey, ooh, her name is Sophie, too. I go, Sophie, wait, I got a question. Does corn go in chili? And she's a foodie, so now we have like a half hour. But I kind of knew right away this is the right woman for me. I'm a lousy cook, she's a cop. But seriously, she's been amazing. So what I thought was really crappy, I had to go. We were incompatible the first one, and we were so perfect together. She's like, that's amazing. Let's just say it's really amazing. And I didn't go looking for it. I didn't try to set it up. I just kept going to my meetings, staying sober, and listening to my sponsor and my network. And I think, what do we have here? Minute 30, we'll give it to you guys. Thank you.